You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. As the dark nights draw in ever closer to the winter solstice, our thoughts can turn to the traditions and festivities that occur around the world at this time of year. To discuss a myriad of folklore topics, my guest this week is the marvellous Icy Sedgwick, host of the wonderful Fabulous Folklore podcast. I can't recommend Icy's show highly enough. It's a weekly treat of marvellously weird folklore, covering a whole range of subjects from a wide spectrum. Every episode I learn something new, so it was a pleasure to have a chance to pick Icy's brain. We cover astronomy, ancient civilizations, Victorian Christmas traditions, Halloween, Krampus, and much, much more. A massive thank you for Icy for joining me on this week's show. Before we get there, don't forget, you can always support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon for $4 a month. You can find the link in this week's show notes, or you can go to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. Don't forget, you can also go to mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes and also to get your merchandise by clicking the links at the top of the page. As always, thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So pour yourself a large glass of eggnog, get the mince pies out, throw another log on the fire, and join me and Icy Sedgwick. Today on Mysteries and Monsters, I am delighted to be joined by fantasy author, blogger, and the host of the wonderful Fabulous Folklore podcast, Icy Sedgwick, with a fascination of the paranormal, folklore, myths and legends. Icy educates and entertains across several mediums. Icy, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
It's fabulous to be here, actually.
Oh, well, thank you for joining me. Now, you're someone I've been aware of for quite a while, primarily, as we were saying off air, to show me just how little I know about folklore, Icy. And often listening to your shows leaves me scurrying to the internet to kind of follow up the subjects that you cover. And I know I've heard you mention that your fascination was kind of started in the paranormal and you've gravitated into folklore. So where did you find this wonderful pamphlet? Because similarly to you, wherever I travel, I try to find the local ghost book.
I've got such a fascination with these pamphlets, and I'm always really gutted when I go somewhere and I can't find one. And yeah, I remember I got them the wrong way around. So I was at some castle, and I forget which one, because let's be honest, Northumberland's got more castles than you can shake a stick at.
Yes.
And it was more Ghosts and Legends of Northumbria. And so I got the sequel first and then went back and read the original one.
Mm.
And I mean, they've got a publication date of like 1992 on them or something like that. And it was a collection of, as you might have gathered by the title, ghost stories and various legends, including things like the Lambton Worm, you know, which is one of the more famous ones I think people will know.
Yeah.
And then we had my favourite one, which is the tunnel that's supposed to lead into like treasure caves under Tynemouth Priory. Yeah. And things like that. And I always prefer the ghost stories. And I'd sort of read the legends and go, yeah, yeah, that's all well and good, but ghosts. And I'd read the ghost ones. I then progressed on to the murders in the North Country and things like that. So I was into true crime when I was like 11. And so basically I did it before it was cool. And then from there, as I got older, it was just like this fascination with just reading lots of books about ghost stories and things. And every time I went anywhere, if there was a section in the guidebook that was about the ghosts, so obviously Glarm's Castle was like the best place ever for me. Hmm. And, you know, you go to the Tower of London and I'm like, yeah, 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 the history stuff's fine, but where are the ghosts and things like that? And I just kind of continued on me merry way, sort of collecting ghost stories about places, and to the extent that I even used to lead ghost walks and take part in overnight ghost investigations and what have you. And then it was 2016, I think it was anyway, Folklore Thursday started on Twitter. And then I started realising that a lot of this other stuff I was also interested, like the fairies, the stories of Northumbria. And these are not fairies that are going to be running around granting your wishes either. They're not the Tinkerbell type of fairies at all.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. I was suddenly like, oh, hang on, this stuff actually has a name. This is not just regional legends. You know, this is an actual like body of knowledge, as it were. And then I just started contributing to that. And the ghosts kind of almost became secondary, because I think some people do see ghost stories and folklore as slightly separate, whereas I kind of see them as part of the same sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like a narrative, but it's not like the official narrative. Mm. It's kind of an accepted folk narrative of a place. And a large part of that is informed by its community, whether that's alive or dead, as far as I'm concerned. And so, yeah, I just kind of went from there. So obviously I do bring the ghost stuff back in as often as I can, because it's my first love, really. But I've noticed when I look at my listening figures that the ghost episodes aren't quite as popular as the legends or the mythology ones. So I think it kind of shows where my listeners are at when it comes to what kind of topics I cover.
It is. And I think it's such a varied subject. And often I think people try to frame folklore as being a specific set of historical narratives or based on regional areas or personal circumstances and things like that. I see. And I think, as you've often referred to when you've done your shows and some of the lectures and your blogs that you do on your website, it's far more complicated than that, because it seems to be often looked as though it's something that happened 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and yet I think we often misunderstand just how much folklore is still embedded in the modern world around us.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I get a little bit frustrated with is there's sometimes a bit of a tendency, I think, for people to look at folklore and go, oh, weren't people silly for doing all of these things and having all these daft beliefs and these strange practices and so on? And I sort of think, no, they were doing the best they could with what they had at the time. Mm. So to me, how is it really any different somebody putting a horseshoe above their door than somebody who always wears the same pair of pants for their first day at work because they're lucky?
Yeah.
Or how is it different from people who will only get in a particular side of a car because that's the lucky side of the car or whatever? And people do these, and obviously, my God, the Friday the 13th stuff. Oh, every year we get inundated with Friday the 13th stuff. And I'm like, first of all, time is essentially a man-made concept. So, yes. You know, and like when you consider the fact that the calendar changed from, you know, I think it's the Julian to the Gregorian, it's like, yeah, you can't just move this stuff around, people. But the, you know, you read all this kind of, and you realise that actually people are still really, really wedded to quite a lot of this stuff even now. And I mean, I am, you know what I mean? But I kind of love that, because I know that these rituals and practices may just be psychological, but I think I don't care if I sort of think, ooh, I have my amethyst pendant on today and I always have a good day when I wear that, and I then go out and I have a good day. It doesn't matter if it's just confirmation bias or if it's just coincidence, because if that is going to help me feel like I'm going to have a better day, then awesome.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, A, it's not hurting anybody, and B, even if there isn't a rational explanation for it, I sort of feel like, does it really matter? And I think that's the thing for me with a lot of these folklore things, because it preserves like that snapshot of what was important to people when they did it, and indeed still do it. Then it kind of captures a lot of information that isn't really stored in any other way.
Mm.
And I think it also shows how humans themselves don't really change. So obviously, urban legends are one of the most obvious examples of what's considered like modern folklore. And you can look at how that can go badly, badly wrong with things like Slender Man.
Mm.
But if you look at a lot of the stories that people will pass on, and they always begin with like, oh, well, a friend of a friend, or, you know, my friend's auntie knew someone who, and then somebody repeats something that clearly sounds almost too good to be true, or just too bizarre to be true.
Mm.
But people then pass them on anyway, and you sort of think, you've literally just passed on folklore, you've literally just entered the folklore narrative. whether you like it or not. So I do think it is quite funny how you can't really pin folklore down that easily, because to me it's almost the unofficial narrative of the population. Rather than it just being this dusty, dry academic thing where someone's gone around and collected a lot of superstitions.
Yeah, and I think, as you've mentioned previously, you've kind of reached out on online and sort of said to people, what does folklore mean to you? And it was quite interesting, because I was thinking about some of the points you were raising there about how entrenched these things are, still are for a lot of people, I see. And as you've mentioned there, my mum, wherever we've lived, we've always had a horseshoe above the front door. Always. As long as I can remember, growing up in the 70s and 80s, wherever we were, there would always be. And when the other year, she was really pleased because she'd got a new horseshoe and I had to put it up for her. And she was delighted that I'd put it there. And it's one of those things that I'd completely forgotten about it. I'd just kind of filed it away in my brain somewhere, I see, and thought, well, that's that. And now, obviously, because of doing this show and getting to know people in Sheffield and at Sheffield Hallam University with their Centre of Contemporary Legend and attending folklore lectures and things like that, I've suddenly realised just how prevalent these things are all around us. So when you look out for people online and you're engaging people in conversations, are you surprised how people don't consider such things to be folklore? They've kind of thought, oh, well, it's a tradition, it's a superstition, but essentially it's got its whole origin in folklore.
I think so, and I know it's quite funny with the horseshoe thing, because when I did the episode on like apotropaic magic and I was looking at things like horseshoes, we've got one above our door, but it's actually made out of wood for some reason. And just to see like why we had one, like I kind of guessed, but I said to my mom, why have we got a horseshoe over the door? And she just went, well, where else would you put it? And I was like, touché. So that's the kind of family I come from. But I think what always I find quite sad, actually, more than anything, is when I'll kind of throw out a question like, oh, has anyone ever seen this, or has anyone ever had this happen, or what's your experiences with this particular superstition or practice or whatever it might be. And I'll get comments, usually on my blog or on YouTube more than anywhere else. And people will be like, oh, people always think I'm crazy, so I don't tell them. And then they tell you the thing. And I always think it's really sad that I might be the first person that person has told about a thing that clearly impacted them enough for them to want to tell someone else about it. And often it can be things like people have had some weird time slip experiences. That was a really interesting comment section on that article. I've had a few people have been posting on the most recent one for seafaring superstitions and things like that. And you tend to get us a lot more on the ghost ones than a lot of my other things. But you do get the sense that somebody was just waiting for an opportunity to almost unburden themselves of this thing. And I'm sitting there thinking, but this in a way isn't just a thing that happened to you, because you're actually part of a wider narrative where something similar will have happened to other people. But because no one ever talks about it, no one ever connects them together to go, well, what's actually going on here? Or indeed just to go, wow, isn't this awesome? We live in a universe that's basically bonkers. And I mean, the scientists even admit that they don't understand things like dark matter. So how can we understand things like seeing doubles and doppelgangers and all that kind of thing? So I think in some ways it is quite interesting to look at the way people almost try and take a step back and go, oh, yeah, that's folklore, but that's not what I do. And I'm like, it totally is. It totally is. And why wouldn't you want to sort of take part in that? Because that, to me, it's almost a way of getting in touch with your humanity.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that it connects people to places and times and history, really. And I think one of the positive aspects of the internet, probably over the last 20 years, I think has allowed a lot of people, I see, to be able to actually find out more about these traditions that seem to have dropped out of fashion. And I think often, because we were all sort of disconnected and we were only in our own communities 30 years ago, before the internet sort of opened the world up to us, I think for a lot of people, like you say there, they kind of kept everything in because they thought they were the only people that had these traditions or followed these strands of folklore, where in reality there's hundreds and thousands of people all over the world that all follow their own sort of historical tracks where they have these set in stone things that their family has always done. As I referred to about the horseshoe, I remember one of the other things that when I've been listening to your show and other folklore podcasts, things like almanacs, which you very rarely see these days. But I remember being a kid growing up, going to my grandparents, and they would always have an almanac on the side. And I never, at the time, I'm sort of 7 or 8 years old, I had no idea what this is. Obviously, I'm fully aware of what they are now, and it's basically a book of predictions and all sorts. But my grandmother used to swear by these things. And often, she'd have 3 or 4 different ones. And they're something you very rarely see these days for sale or in bookshops. You might stumble across them occasionally in sort of local bookshops that are connected with their community and maybe more in the art scene, I see. And it's... For me, it's sad when things like that drop out of fashion, because I think we can learn a lot about people and places by utilising these documents and this historical record to give us an idea of just how prevalent these things really are.
Absolutely. And I think when you were just talking there, one of the things that sort of sprang to mind for me was when I was thinking how it's really important to actually ask people yourself what their traditions and practices and things are. I mean, I remember when I first wrote an article for Folklore Thursday a few years ago now about First Fun, and it used to be a really big thing here in the Northeast, and obviously also in Scotland and Ireland and so on as well. But obviously from my experience, it was obviously in the Northeast of England. And it's something obviously that I know I'm not supposed to do it because, you know, oh, you can't let a girl do it, but, you know, I'm going to do it anyway if there's no one else in the family doing it.
Yeah.
And I would have to explain this to people because they'd never heard of it before. And they were kind of looking at me like, oh, you're taking part in this superstitious nonsense. And I'm just like, yes, because I don't want to not. And I think when you then look at, it's almost the one problem with the internet, while yes, on the one hand, it's made it much easier to access this information and to find things like old copies of almanacs, or indeed, I've got about 8 different floriography dictionaries from different points in the Victorian period of what different flowers meant at different times.
Yes.
And you can find them for free on things like archive.org, and you can access all these wonderful, wonderful books. But then there's also the other downside of the internet, and that's the homogenization of information. So it then almost gets boiled down to, oh, this person has shared 3 commandments of how you should approach an eclipse.
Yes.
And then people just go, oh, well, I've seen it on Instagram, so it must be true. And then people then start just following the same tradition that they've seen somebody do online.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, what about personal experience, though? Like, what about your personal preferences? What about the fact that, you know, in the same way that I would argue that if you were following a baking recipe, for example, now I never follow a recipe properly, ever, because I'm what my mother calls a Chucky Inn cook. And apparently my gran was the same. So you kind of do it, you sort of kind of have the guidelines, and then you do the rest of it by eye.
Yeah.
And the only downside is sometimes things can be amazing and you have no idea how you did them, so you can't replicate them again.
Mm.
And I sort of feel like people's approach to life should be the same, that you go, well, I've got my general guidelines, like I've got to exercise, I should really eat my greens, etc., etc. But then everything else is kind of what works for me.
Mm.
But instead, you then get people slavishly following information that's presented to them. And I think where it comes to folklore, myself and a couple of the other people on Folklore Thursday were discussing this a few weeks ago, I think now, about the fact that one of the problems that you then get is someone might share a snippet of a folk belief that's prevalent, say, in Lincolnshire, for whatever reason. And then someone else goes, oh, that's not what I've heard. And either they're from Lincolnshire, but they just haven't heard that version because it was actually a family tradition, or they're actually from Dorset, in which case, well, of course, the belief's going to be ever so slightly different because it's a different part of the country. And people can then get really annoyed if you share a piece of folklore that sounds vaguely like what they thought they knew, but is slightly different. You go, well, no, because the interesting bits are in the differences,
yeah,
not necessarily where it's where it's the same. Is also really interesting, particularly when you then start looking at a more macro level across entire countries or continents and things like that, and you can then go, oh wow, isn't this really interesting? Like, slight detour, but I'm reading a book about the mythology of the Pleiades at the moment, by Munya Andrews, and she's talking about the way that there's very, very similar myths about the Pleiades from the Indigenous Australians, but then also the Indigenous Americans. And they didn't meet, they didn't swap stories. But then when you sit and look at them from similar time periods, you're like, wow, these are really similar. So there, the similarities are really interesting because it then leads you to wonder why.
Mm.
But I think from what I'm talking about with a lot of the stuff that you then get shared on social media, it then just kind of gets flattened out and the interesting edges knocked off until it's then all the same. And that sort of gets a bit frustrating because you think it's not preserving knowledge anymore. It's just basically repeating the same accepted rehash. So it's a little bit like almost a copy of a copy of a copy.
Mm.
And at that point, I think I'm not sure what the value of it is.
Yeah, it does seem sometimes that it's almost as if there has to be a prescribed version of whatever it is. And as you say, you know, even here in the UK, even if you look at things as normal to us, as accents, I see, you know, mm-hmm. you know, when often people from outside of the UK come here, they don't understand often just how different accents can be. Even where I live in Yorkshire, South Yorkshire accent doesn't sound like East Yorkshire.
Oh, not at all.
Or North Yorkshire or West Yorkshire, you know, and I've spent some time in Northumberland and in that area. So I can, you know, I'm one of those people who can understand the difference between a Geordie accent and a Macam accent, but also a Northumbrian accent, you know. So I can tell the difference. And even coming further down the coast, when you get to places like Middlesbrough, which are kind of stuck halfway between Yorkshire and Northumberland, yeah. where they're not really, unless you know the area, most people don't understand, they kind of try and fit them in either way, which upsets anybody from Middlesbrough, because they're quite happy to be where they are. But it's the same even if you look at like Liverpool and Manchester, and you have towns like Warrington, which has this strange kind of mix of their accent between them. And even if you look at it on that level, there are so many variations of talking in the same language, but how we talk is going to have no resemblance to how people in Cornwall or as you say, Dorset and Devon and places like that talk. Christ, even Cornwall and Devon can't agree in the way to eat a scone. Never mind anything else, I see, you know. So when it comes to things like folklore and tradition, I like these little changes and differences that each county or town or city has. And I think they should be celebrated rather than sort of smashed together to create this acceptable version.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, my favourite part of the whole thing, because I suppose as a part of me quite loves chaos, and one of the bits I really like is when you'll have two competing beliefs. So one place, and you get this with hawthorn, where most people accept that you don't bring hawthorn in the house at any time of year, except May Day.
Yeah.
And because obviously to do so was considered bad luck. And I've forgotten where it is now off the top of my head, but there's somewhere where they actually say, yes, you can use it as something else. And it's, I'm sure, use bad luck to bring in the house. Now that's probably because it's incredibly toxic.
Mm.
But in one county, it was considered an acceptable part of your Christmas decorations.
Yeah.
So I always love the fact that there's always at least one county that just goes, no, we're not going to do the same as everyone else. We're going to have our own thing. And that always absolutely tickles me because I sort of think, well, did they do that on purpose or did someone just mishear something? So somebody's gone to visit a town to do some trading and they've not really been listening properly. So they've just kind of heard with like half an ear. And then they've come back with the distorted version, and then people have picked up the distorted version and then run with it. And so to me, I'm always interested in kind of the why, but I love the fact that folklore does change from place to place. Mm. And then you do get some that are really specific because they're related to like a feature in the landscape or something. But yeah, no, I'd sort of feel like trying to make all folklore the same for a particular area is just, I think that's, you're on a hiding at nothing if you start trying to do that.
Yeah. I know I've heard you mention things like megaliths and standing stones and the like. And that's another subject where I think a lot of people just presume that they all match up with the solstices. But when you start to dive into them, there's very few that actually work on that principle. And yet, I think if you ask people about stone circles and things like that, I see, they will say, oh, well, they were all made to match the solstice. And that's how they work. But I was surprised to see just how few of them actually do work on that principle.
Yeah, and I think that's the funny thing with with things like Stand and so on, because there's part of me like really, really, really hopes, and I know this probably isn't the case, but it hopes that somewhere in the past there was a megalithic human with a really wicked sense of humour who decided to put them up just to prank future generations. And I don't think that's the case, but I would love it if it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was quite surprised when I learned that, and I was like, oh wow, so actually more of them don't line up with the solstices than do.
Mm.
Which then makes you question, well, the ones that do line up with the solstices, that kind of makes their function a little bit clearer. But the ones that don't, you then think, well, what are they for? But then I sort of think, well, when you look at, you know, we obviously live in buildings, but they all have different functions. So, you know, you might look at our building and be like, right, okay, that's actually a warehouse. Mm. And that one's an airport hangar. But to all intents and purposes, they look the same from the outside, but you'd never use them for the same sort of function. So why would stone circles be any different? And I know there is one theory, and I have a feeling this probably isn't right, and it's a shame, but there are a couple of stone circles where they're actually believed to align with Arcturus in the Boots constellation and Vega in the Lyra constellation.
Oh.
And even if that's not the case, the fact that somebody even believed that to me is really interesting, because when you then start having things aligned to celestial things like the fixed stars, that makes it a little bit more, well, where were they going with that? Why those stars? Why those constellations?
Yeah.
And then obviously, why did that person think that they were important? So in some ways, I kind of think the ones that aren't aligned to the solstices are probably more interesting than the ones that are.
Yeah, well, they can't explain them. And I think that's the problem, because often, as people will mention, I think we tend to accept a educational explanation for things, I see. And when it comes to things like that, I think people are confused then, because they don't understand the concept. We then have to try and think, well, what were people doing 3,000 years ago? Why were they building this? Because recently I went to Whitby and got some pamphlets on the local ghost stories while I was there, which I was delighted with.
Excellent.
But on the way back, we stopped off at a little village called Rudston, which has the largest monolith in the UK. And they reckon that's been there since 2000 BC. So it's been there best part of 4,000 years. It's kind of on a little hill surrounded by a dip, and then you've got hills all the way around it. They reckon it's been dragged 10, 15 miles to get there. Nobody knows why it's there, why they built it. And when you come across things like that, I always find things like this incredible, because it's looking at a period of history that we know very little about, really, and how these people viewed themselves in the world around them. And often people will say, oh, well, it was probably done as some kind of solstice symbol or some kind of congregation point. But with the greatest respect, we've no idea most of the time, because other than some basic archaeology that we can do in these areas, often these places are just chosen. And I often find these questions really interesting, because you think, well, what made this area so attractive to these people? Why did they want this stone here? Why did they want to come here? What brought them here in the first place? And it's things like that that I find really, really deeply interesting.
I think there is also so a tendency with things like that, where when people always assume that, oh, it looks very deliberate, it must be ritual, that you think, yeah, but think how much, like if you try and look at it from a 21st century point of view,
yeah,
and I think about where I have furniture in my bedroom, none of it's there for ritual purposes. It's there because it either fitted in that space, or I liked how it looked, or there was nowhere else to put it. It's basically those three kind of things. And I often think, why couldn't the ancients also just do things because they liked how it looked, or it fitted there, or there was nowhere else to put it?
Yeah.
And I think because we also, it takes such a leap of imagination, I think, to, because there's no way of knowing what the landscape itself actually looked like until you start getting into excavations and looking for trees and all that kind of thing. But generally speaking, just looking at a site, you can't know what it looked like when it was first installed. So it's a little bit like really random example. But if you look at the Angel of the North, sorry, Anthony Gormley, that was an eyesore when it first went up. It really was. And I still think it's a shame it doesn't still have its Shearer shirt, but that's just me. But it looked awful. But now the trees around the bay, like on the hill below it, have now matured. Mm. It looks really cool, and it now looks embedded in the landscape. It looks like it belongs, and it's just. It, and I know he wants to have them cut down, and I'm like, no, they actually set the angel off better.
Yeah,
because it kind of gives the whole site more of a visual continuity.
Mm.
And I mean, that's what gardeners like Capability Brown used to do. They could see what it was going to look like when it was finished in 30 or 40 years' time. And that's what they would design it based on. And for some reason, people really don't seem able to grant that people 3,000, 4,000 years ago might have also been possessed of the same kind of abilities.
Yeah.
And might have actually gone, oh, you know what, we'll put this here. Because, yeah, it might be a meeting point, because that's a nice practical reason to put something in. But there could be any number of reasons which we just don't understand, because their behaviour is different from ours, in the same way that they probably wouldn't understand why we all sit in front of glowing boxes all day.
Yeah.
So it's, and I must admit, this is a soapbox I frequently climb up onto, about this idea a lot of people have of ancient peoples as being primitive.
Yeah.
And you go, yes, they didn't have our technological advances. And yes, you know, they hadn't gone through a lot of the development that we enjoy now. But let's be honest, like how many people actually know how broadband works? How many people actually understand the circuitry in their mobile phone? Probably, unless that's your job, not that many. But people like to think, oh, well, we've got smartphones, so we're more advanced. And you're like, no, you use smartphones.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
Mm.
And I think that when you look at things like, well, any of the monuments in ancient Egypt are a really good example, and you look at the astrology done by the ancient Mesopotamians and you're like, this is phenomenal that they did all of that with different stuff than what we have, and so they can't possibly have been primitive. So I like to give people the ancient Britons the benefit of the doubt that they obviously had a reason for doing whatever it was, even if we don't know what that reason was now. Mm. But I do think that it's quite wrong to look back and either assume that they were really superstitious or whatever, and or to assume that they were doing the wrong thing, because it was obviously the right thing for them to do at the time.
Yeah, and I think you can apply that to most civilizations across the world. When we look back at them, there is this kind of, as you say, sort of modern rose-tinted glasses where we think, oh, they were all savages, they were all so primitive. And yet you can go across most continents, I see, and you will find things that prove that point to be wrong, regardless of what sort of practical situation you wish to sort of prescribe to these people. They would often deal with situations that we, in a modern sense, probably wouldn't have the first idea of how to deal with. I mean, like you've said there about modern technology and smartphones, how many people these days know how to make a fire? If you give them, you know, wood and stick them in there, they're struggling unless you give them a lighter and some fuel. And yet these people were able to cook and clean and catch animals and eat and feed and grow crops. You know, they didn't have books to read. They couldn't go online to sort of download the instructions or watch somebody else do it. Everything was practical. It was passed on. It was word of mouth. It was knowledge that was shared and evolved upon, and people would build upon different things based on that kind of practicality, which I think often in this day and age, we've completely lost sight of, because everything is simply at the touch of a button for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's also, dare I say it, a degree of arrogance that some people have. And I'm just thinking, when you look at a lot of the initiatives, so like the land back initiatives in America, to hand a lot of the land stewardship back to the indigenous people, because they know how to look after it. And yet there'll still be people who will kind of go, oh, no, we know best.
Yeah.
And it's like, but you clearly don't.
Mm.
And I mean, I get annoyed about this all the time in the UK, because when you look at the, you know, all the cutting down the ancient woodland and so on for HS2.
Yeah.
And, oh, but we're going to plant some saplings. It's like, yeah, but how long before they get to the point where they're able to do the same job as the ancient trees? You know, you can't replace an ancient woodland overnight.
Mm.
And the ancient woodland is quite happily taking carbon out of the atmosphere for free. So if you want to be like carbon neutral and all that, why are you cutting down the best contributors to that? But that's another soapbox for another time. And I think that this is where a lot of our sort of knowledge in this country, our knowledge of the land has been lost, because I think people have become really disconnected with it. So, I mean, there's loads of really cool rewilding initiatives in Scotland, for example.
Yeah.
And I would love to see, and I know the Woodland Trust are doing some of that in England as well, but I would love to see more of that. But I think that part of it really does require that reconnection of people with the land on which they live. Because, I mean, that was one of the things that was really interesting when I asked that question, what brought you to folklore? And lots of people actually replied saying things like, oh, you know, my family used to take me out telling me the stories of where I lived. Awesome, class. That's your reconnection with the land. Or people saying, oh, I moved to a new area and I wanted to learn something about where I was and I discovered all these stories. Excellent, brilliant. You've connected with the land you've moved to. And I think it's we get so hung up on forming relationships with other people, whether that's to get a better job or to advance ourselves at work or to do whatever it might be, climb the social ladder and so on. We forget the relationships with our environment, and they're just as important, because like you were saying, most people, I mean, I don't know how to build a fire. Mm. I'm hoping I'm never in a situation where I need to.
Yeah.
But I can recognize a lot more plants than I think, mostly because I know what a lot of the poisonous ones look like because they're my favourites.
Yeah.
But it's because they're the most interesting. They've got the best folklore, basically.
Yeah.
But it's the fact that, you know, so I think, well, at least I've got that connection. Like, I can recognise trees. You know, I can recognise animals and bird cries and things. And it's because of the fact that I've taken this interest in folklore.
Mm.
And I've particularly taken the interest in the lore and legends and folk practices of the bit that I live in.
Yeah.
So I think that, and you can also apply equally the same thing to the urban environment as well, weirdly enough. You know, and I think that that's where psychogeography is really interesting as a practice to sort of orient yourself in the urban landscape.
Mm.
But I do think that the beauty of folklore is the fact that it does reconnect you with wherever you are. And I think that once you do that and you start realizing that you're basically just part of a bigger organism, it becomes a bit harder to behave negatively towards it. So as an example, during lockdown one last year, I think it was lockdown one because, yeah, it would have been.
Mm.
I used to walk to the paper shop to get the papers for me authorized exercise every day. And I hadn't been on that particular walk, and I got to go past trees and a little burn and all that kind of thing. And it was brilliant because I got to see the changing of the season. So I actually documented like a whole year doing these walks and sort of seeing what came out at different times and what plants and animals you could see and yeah, things like that.
Yeah.
And it was great because I sort of felt, yep, I now feel more rooted where I live, because I mean, I'm born and raised here. Did spend some time in London as well, so that's like my second home, but largely speaking, this is my home.
Mm.
Felt a lot more connected to it. But then I would walk along and some idiot would have then hung a bag of dog poo from a tree, and I'm like, first of all, like, what kind of weird god are you trying to summon with that offering? And secondly, like, that required an awful lot of effort for you to go and do that. You could have just put it in the bin, you know. And I used to sort of think, if you had any kind of connection to the place where you live, you wouldn't do that, because you'd be like, well, hopefully you don't leave them hanging around in your house. So why would you do it in the area you live in? And I think, and obviously the jokes about like raising, you know, Cthulhu through dog poo bags on trees aside and so on, I think that, although that would be a plot twist that I think nobody saw coming for the end of 2021. And let's be honest, it feels like all bets are off at this point.
Absolutely.
But I think that it is a really good way of making sure that you feel like you're actually grounded somewhere.
Yeah, it is interesting, I think, because obviously I live in Sheffield and it prides itself on being a very green city. You know, I live a stone's throw away from one of the several parks that we have in the area and the urban landscape around here, and we're 10 minutes from the Peak District. So we are spoilt for choice, and it is remarkable, as you say. One of the things that struck me during lockdown was often you can go out to the peaks and you'll hardly see anybody, and then it was almost as if everybody had suddenly discovered, after being locked up for 3 months, that there was an outside world, because we thought, oh, we'll have a nice drive out to one of the reservoirs and go for a good walk, enjoy, you know, have a leisurely Sunday stroll, and you couldn't park within 3 miles of the place. It was like everybody in Cheshire and Yorkshire had all decided this one particular day they would go to this reservoir that clearly none of them had ever been to. Mm. And it's it was remarkable to see how many people had suddenly decided to start doing things that they probably hadn't considered before. And the other interesting aspect of that was how quickly that kind of dropped off as well, which I found quite peculiar, because often we hope and we prescribe this kind of positivity to terrible situations that we've all been through. And I think it was very interesting looking at the kind of aspects of the way people faced our first lockdown here in the UK, and it was quite positive and people were doing a lot of reconnecting and everybody was kind of in it together. And then when the second one kicked off towards the end of last year, a lot of people kind of regressed and went back into themselves again. And I noticed it was a very different situation. Now, maybe that's because it was the time of year and the nights were drawing in, whereas the first one, it was spring and we were all sort of focusing on the summer. I see. And I'm not sure if that maybe had some kind of overall aspect to it. But it was very interesting just how very different people began to sort of react to things around them.
Yeah, and I think it was really interesting because I know in the first one, I sort of remember sort of actually being quite excited by the number of online talks and so on that was suddenly available. And I'm something of the introvert. And, you know, if something's available online, great. You know, I love doing things online. But I think obviously because you could sort of tell as the year wore on and people were actually allowed to go outside and so on, given the choice, people were obviously going back to wanting to do things in person, which obviously great, you know, you obviously need human contact and so on. But I did notice that there seemed to almost be a drop off of interest in online events and so on. And it did sort of make me wonder if, you know, how much some of the interest people had sort of developed fell by the wayside once they could go back to the way things had been before. And then how many people actually sort of went, actually, no, I like that thing that I took up. I mean, I think a lot of the people who took up baking banana bread probably were like, I never need to look at banana bread again in my life. But I think because, you know, I've certainly enjoyed a lot of the online stuff, but I think because it gave me the opportunity to learn from people. And I mean, Victor Wynne's Last Tuesday Society, done so many talks with the likes of Professor Ronald Hutton and Owen Davies and people like that. And it's like, well, I would never get the chance to see them speak in person. So now I've got the chance to learn from them online. And I think it's a funny one because I think people are still in a bit of a liminal place where we're not as we were before the pandemic, but we're also not out of the pandemic either. And I think if you're good at that both and mindset where, you know, you can hold two things in your head at once. And I think that people have probably been able to weather that and be a bit more flexible. But people where it's either we're out of it or we're not. I think that's where people have then sort of been struggling a little bit.
Yeah, very much so. I can be very introverted at times, but I also like the ability to be an extrovert when I wish to. And I have found it quite interesting that the introverted side of me, my personality, seems to have grown over the last 18 months. And I tend to be more sort of reflective in my own space these days, whereas before I would often crave to be outside doing different things or socializing more. And now I seem to be quite happy not doing that as much. And I seem to be more, I've always read and I've always kind of wanted to sort of learn things and discover new pools of knowledge. But I tend to focus more on that. And one of the big, you know, I hardly watch any television anymore unless it's strange documentaries about ghosts and monsters and things like that I see and things that I don't know much about and I want to learn more about. Whereas normally I would be quite a casual watcher. I didn't watch a lot, but I tend to watch a lot less than I even did before.
I think I probably watch about the same in terms of quantity, but what I watch, I mean, I've never been, like, I'm not a box set binger. I haven't got the attention span. So I much prefer kind of sitting watching like a good documentary. So obviously if it's like a history documentary, I'm probably all over it.
Yeah.
And one of the things I've discovered a love for and a fascination in has actually been astronomy.
Yeah.
Because obviously I think anyone who's listening to the podcast will know that I've obviously got an interest in astrology, particularly ancient astrology or traditional astrology, as it's sometimes called, and how that dovetails with all the myths of the constellations and you know, the myths of the individual, the planets and so on. I find all that stuff really interesting. But then I've basically, it's taken us like 10 years to do this. So I've cottoned on really late, but I finally discovered The Joy of Brian Cox. And I know I've been watching his recent series Universe on BBC.
Mm.
And in a way, I kind of feel like it's been such a perfect antidote to a lot of things that have happened because of the fact that you suddenly realise that you're this tiny, 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 tiny speck of a speck on a tiny speck in an absolutely whopping great galaxy in a whopping great universe. And it kind of puts a lot of things into perspective. And particularly starts going on about what the end of the universe is going to be like. And I just think of Death in the Sandman, where she's going to put all the chairs on the table and turn the lights off on the way out.
Yeah.
And he doesn't quite put it as eloquently as that, but then again, he's not Neil Gaiman. But no. I think in a way, it's been good to kind of reconnect with like a sense of wonder and curiosity and awe for the world that I live in, because there's so many things to really despise about the world and the way that humans in particular behave. So I think I've kind of leaned towards sort of content like that. And in a way, I do think this is what ties back into what I was saying about the ancients earlier, how I think it's hilarious how Brian will come out with something about like the universe. And I'm like, the ancients knew about that. they just coded it in a legend that people look at and go, oh, isn't that a silly myth? Yeah. You're like, no, they knew this. And one of my favourite ones is the fact that just because of the way that obviously the Earth's rotation works, but it looks like the Scorpius constellation, which most people would know as Scorpio, rises as Orion sets. So they kind of chase each other. Well, Scorpio basically chases Orion around the heavens, which fits in with the myth that Scorpius was the Scorpio sent by Artemis to kill Orion for one of two reasons. And it's like, so the ancients had observed this change and they'd encapsulated it in a story to sort of explain this phenomena that they could observe. And then people sit there going, oh, isn't mythology silly? And I'm like, well, some of it's a little bit far-fetched, but we're missing something in the translation for what this actually referred to. And it's really funny, as I say, then going and watching a science documentary and going, I know what you're talking about.
Well, I think, yeah, often in these old cultures, there is a lot of explanations for things that, as we touched on, that they're often not given the credit for. And even if they are dressing them up in a tale or a myth, it is showing a level of understanding that we often forget about. And as you refer to, if there's one thing I like to watch, I see, that keeps me grounded, is I've always loved The Sky at Night.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily because I can watch that and just have my mind blown in about 30 minutes, even though I've had a long interest like you in space and the universe and how the world around us works and our galaxies and things like that. So whenever I watch that, I will always find something new, or I will just shake my head at the situations. I was watching something about Pluto the other day, and I was like, what? How does this happen? About how they realise that there's clearly a sea on Pluto because there aren't many craters there. So that shows that it isn't a permanent ice sheet on the planet, because if it was, it'd be covered in craters, and it isn't. So therefore, we now think that there is some kind of core that is creating this melting of ice, which to most people, they would just consider Pluto to be an ice. And I was just blown away. I was thinking, I've never even heard of this. So I'm with you all the way on that.
And I think this is the thing as well. Like, when this is the thing that I think that we can absolutely learn from scientists and apply it to other things. And I think that's particularly when it comes to space and so on, because I mean, they're discovering new things like all the time. And they'll go, ooh, we thought this thing, but now we've got more information. We now know that it's this other thing.
Yeah.
Or they'll go, we've got this thing called dark matter. We don't know what it is or how it works, but it's the only thing that explains everything. And they're quite willing to update knowledge as they get more, or as they put different bits together and so on. And I think that's something that people as a whole aren't really very good at doing. And I think, you know, obviously you need only look at echo chambers on Facebook to see this, that sort of one person's heard a conspiracy theory about microchips and vaccines, and then all of a sudden everyone else goes, oh, well, my friend said, so it must be true. And you then present them with like a million case studies on why that's nonsense, and they'll still be like, oh, but I'm going to cling to my belief because that's what I believe and I don't want to be wrong. And it's like, but you're not wrong. You're just simply saying, well, I did believe this one thing, but now I actually believe this other thing, and that's okay. You're allowed to change your mind. And I think it's so brilliant when you see these advances and these changes. And I mean, even if you look in science itself, I mean, way back in the day when Galen was the one writing the books about history of medicine and all he'd ever been able to dissect was dogs, some of the stuff he came out with about the circulation system was absolutely crazy. Yes. And, you know, it took until the 18th century when someone actually figured out how it worked. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the original stuff that you look back and go, oh, anyone who believed that was a simpleton. You just go, well, that they just believed what they could with what they had at the time. So I think that it's not a bad thing to go, yeah, I thought that as well, but then I heard this other thing, or I looked at this other evidence. And I do mean proper evidence. It's like being peer reviewed and whatnot. It's not just some random video on YouTube. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm such a stickler on my blog and in my podcast for, and obviously they're not so much in the podcast because obviously the references are all on the blog post, but you can go and have a look at the references that I've used. You can go and read the books, read the articles, follow the same research I did. And if you might come to a completely different conclusion to me, I don't know. But it's just the fact that I want to sort of, because this is the training that I've got, obviously, like, because my degrees are in history of art and film studies. And it's all about being able to interpret information to come up with a reading or an analysis of something. So I sort of think, well, that's basically how I view reality. I'm given a series of evidence, I've got a series of theories to work with, and then I have to come up with something at the end of it. So I just applied the same process to folklore and to my blog and so on. So I hope that my ultimate goal really is to say, basically, first of all, here's a research methodology. When I go, do your research, I'm actually giving you a reading list.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's the fact that I'm hoping that there's enough in the episodes, because they are only 15 minutes long, just because otherwise it would take me too long to do each one. And with all the best will in the world, I've got other things to do, unfortunately, you know, like a day job and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's the fact that I hope that it then inspires someone to go off and find their own information about the things that they find interesting. So it's, if I manage to sort of persuade somebody to go and develop their own research methodology, or to go and find out more about a topic that really captures their interest, whatever it might be, or anything like that, or it just basically gets them to think critically about the information that they come across. Like every time I mention Pliny the Elder, and God bless Pliny, I must talk about him at least every other episode.
Yeah.
And this stuff he wrote down, oh, honestly, you're like, dude, were you either super gullible or were you just faithfully writing everything down and someone's missed the point?
Yeah.
But he would write these things down, and I'm sure people were making stuff up just to see what they could get him to believe.
Yeah.
But he faithfully records all this wealth of stuff, some of which you do look at and go, really? And because he's about the only source we have for what the Druids did, because they didn't write down what they did themselves, you have to go, right, okay, this is what he's written down, but let's have a look at why did he write it down? Who did he write it down for? Oh, hang on, might he have been biased because he was writing it for the Romans who were trying to wipe out the Druids? Oh, maybe. And then it colours what he's saying. And then you have to think critically about, well, what is he saying? Is it actually likely to just be PR? And that's the kind of thing that I want people to be able to take away and then do for themselves on things that they see going on around them. You know, so obviously if you've got a difference between a scientist who's devoted their life to epidemiology telling you one thing, and then somebody who just last week was telling you that it was safe to eat Tide Pods, they're telling you something completely different. Maybe have a think about which one might be more likely to know what they're talking about. So that's sort of the approach that I think I take in general, but also the kind of approach that I'd like people to be able to take away from it. So yes, you can listen to the podcast and just be like, wow, I didn't know that. But you might also take something away from it and go, you know what? I'm going to assume that the Prime Minister might be a little bit like a modern day Pliny the Elder. And I'm not saying that he is, but that's the first thing that popped into my head. But you know what I mean? So it's kind of, it's one of those sort of things where I just want people to be able to sort of look at things from a slightly more objective position.
Yeah, it is very interesting, that whole kind of perception that we have, that often, as you say, we look back at some of these historical writers and diarists and presume that what they're saying is exactly how it was. And it's like when we come to talk about things about winter and how certain cultures celebrated it and Christmas and how it became. A lot of it, we've no idea why people did what they did or why it's so entrenched in our kind of psyche, I see, that we now still sort of hark back to things like why was Holly and Ivy so revered? Why were these members of the plant kingdom dealt with in such a way by certain cultures? And why do we do certain things on certain days? And why in Ireland do they think that robins kill wrens at Christmas and things like that? And often I think people will say, oh, well, we know this is the reason. Where a lot of it, they're just guessing, or in certain situations, they're just making things up to fit their preconceived bias or what they want to get across.
Exactly, and that is one of the other pitfalls that you have with a lot of folklore, particularly the stuff written in the 19th century. Mm. It's very much written with an agenda.
Yeah.
And it's very much written where people are taking a standpoint and sometimes working backwards. So one of the ones I did most recently for Cresswell Crags was a talk about Halloween and sort of where a lot of our sort of traditions like pumpkins and apple bobbing and things like that come from. And it was hilarious because there's a whole chapter on Samhain in Ronald Hutton's Stations of the Sun, and which I highly recommend to anyone who wants to learn more about the so-called ritual year of Britain. And I think what you have to remember when you look at people talking about, you know, like the Wheel of the Year and the eight major feasts and blah this and blah that, and people talk about them being these pagan festivals, those dates were essentially established by a combination of people in the late 19th century and 20th century, based on their interpretation of evidence, or in some cases, lack thereof. So it's one of those things where you cannot possibly look back at this mythical, unified pagan past, because as we've said already, people do things differently in different places, even now. So why would we assume that that communities who had no contact with each other, why would they assume that they would all do things the same way? And one of the things that you have about why people sort of celebrate the Festival of the Dead thing at Halloween, it was Sir James Fraser who looked at what people were doing now and then worked backwards from that point to try and establish a why, rather than looking for evidence in the past and working forwards. And he was the one who decided that there must have been a Celtic festival at the dead at the same time, and that the Christians had stolen the date. And that is a thing that I keep seeing repeated again and again and again in articles. But those writers never cite their sources to say where that particular belief comes from. And it's frustrating because of the fact that when you then look at all the evidence that Hutton puts forward, it looks like they actually chose the date in November for All Saints Day and All Souls Day based on what the Germanic churches and Germanic areas were doing, not what was happening in the Celtic nations. So you think, so where did this idea of this pan-Celtic festival come from? Because each of the Celtic nations have their own traditions.
Yeah.
And they're being obliterated by trying to make it this pan-Celtic thing. No, look at them in their own right.
Yeah.
Look at what Wales was doing. Look at what Scotland was doing. Look at what Ireland was doing. And respect these places. Don't try and make them all one homogenous. It's that homogenization again.
Yeah.
And it's far more interesting. And there are people better qualified to talk about each of those nations than I am. But I wish that people would actually look at these individual places and their individual practices and honour those, rather than saying, oh, everybody was doing the same thing in the same way at the same time. We said, well, we only think that because Sir James Fraser said so. So again, it's one of those things of, yes, you can look at what people do now and honour that. You can look at what people did 100 years ago and honour that. And you can look, but once you get to the point where history's not being written down, you've got to be very careful about people making assumptions based on a supposition that they've come up with based on like the now, or obviously in Sir James Fraser's day, the then. And it's again, it's just something to bear in mind that you don't know why something was done the way it was if it hasn't been written down. And even then, it was interesting because I did an episode on sort of like the folklore of childbirth and pregnancy and so on. And a lot of the stuff wasn't written down. Why? Because men didn't think it was worth recording. Mm. So you suddenly lose all of these, this really valuable folk knowledge because it wasn't written down because somebody didn't deem it worthwhile. So it's a bit of a minefield, I think, when you start actually looking for information on things.
Yeah. Well, it's like our concept of Christmas these days. Essentially, a lot of it was rewritten and created by the Victorians because they suddenly became obsessed with Christmas. And we forget that for a lot of people, they maybe had Christmas Day off and maybe Good Friday off back in those days. And the rest of the time, they were all expected to work, apart from in, you know, certain localities would have different working schedules and some more prudent cotton mill owners and miners and things like that, mine owners, they would allow their staff a little bit more time off. But the general consensus was that basically everybody worked the vast majority of the year. And we have this kind of halcyon view of the past that everybody had 12 days of Christmas and we all went round carol singing all the time and sharing chestnuts and giving gifts. And yet, when you really dive into it, I mean, I don't think Boxing Day became a bank holiday till the latter part of the 19th century anyway. So, you know, when people look at things like A Christmas Carol and presume, you know, once again, that Dickens created the Christmas story or the Christmas ghost story, as it was, when you get past the preconceived notions of what we believe, none of it's true. And we have to kind of unpick it all because it's kind of like a piecemeal jigsaw of things that they liked and things they didn't like. And, you know, like Christmas cards were basically sent because one guy got sick of writing letters, I believe. And that's when that started at that period. And it all seems that we often look back with these rose-tinted glasses looking at how we view Christmas 150 years ago and presume that everybody everywhere in the UK was all sat around together for 12 days between Christmas and New Year, all making merry and having fun, when now we know that that simply wasn't the case.
Well, this is the thing, and I think that's where, I mean, when you consider something like the Christmas card was only made possible because we had a postal service was invented. And the Christmas tree, that bastion of Christmas decoration, is relatively new, all things considered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it was really interesting, actually, when I did that talk for Christmas traditions. And I'd, again, done that thing of going, oh, this must be what it was like. And then I stopped and I thought, hang on a minute, that can't be the case, though. Because I remember, and this is a weird source to look to, but Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. And I thought, at no point does she really discuss them celebrating Christmas.
Yeah.
She mentions Michaelmas at one point, but there's no huge celebration. And Jane Austen was very good at putting sort of what people were doing, obviously in a particular class, but still.
Yeah.
Like how they did things. She was very good at basically keeping that written down in fiction and so on. But she doesn't really mention it. So you kind of go, hang on. So maybe it wasn't a big thing. And I mean, my parents are both doing their family trees, and on my dad's side in particular, he keeps finding people who, like ancestors who got married on Christmas Day. And it's like, no, that wasn't some romantic thing where they want to have a big gesture in the spirit of the season. It was because it was the day they had off.
Yeah.
And when you start looking at things from that point of view, and also the thing that you see a lot of is people keep trying to link modern day festivals with, like, particularly Roman festivals. And it's a really attractive thing to do. And in some cases, I kind of wish they'd bring them back.
Yes.
I mean, the Vulcanalia is one of my favourites, and that one's August 23rd. But I'm quite partial to Vulcan because he's a really cool god.
Yeah.
But you look at the Saturnalia, and again, Saturnalia is amazing. I mean, they'd find a way to ruin it with Christmas advert, or with adverts, rather, I should say, and merchandise and tat if they try to bring it back now. But I think, again, it was because there was a lot of Victorians looked backwards and drew a link to Saturnalia. But you think, well, why is there no evidence of people celebrating Saturnalia? I mean, obviously, the Tudors were massive on Christmas. They were huge on it.
Yeah.
And there obviously is evidence of them doing the proper 12 days of Christmas. And I know Lucy Worsley did an entire series about, or she did an entire documentary about it.
Yeah.
But then you have this massive gap where people just kind of, the day sort of passed unobserved sort of thing. And I think that you think, well, if people had continued this unbroken tradition of Saturnalia, there would be far more evidence of it.
Yeah.
So I think that, again, that was one of those things that I had heard and thought it sounded good and assumed it must be the case. But then you actually go, oh, hang on a minute. It might have, the idea of celebration might have its original roots then, but the actual practices are very different. And I think that it's okay to acknowledge that a tradition might only be 200 years old. Mm. I don't think a tradition needs to be thousands and thousands and thousands of years old to be legitimate. And that is one of the other problems that I see quite a lot. People go looking for this ancient heritage for things,
yeah,
as if that's going to somehow legitimize them. And you're like, sometimes, no, they're not. I mean, for example, this year, I came across the concept for the first time of the Halloween tree.
Right.
There's literally no reason why that makes sense at all.
Okay.
But someone's obviously decided, I'm going to have a black and orange tree for Halloween. I say, fair play to you. You yep. crack right on. You're not hurting anyone. But in like 200 years' time, that might be a thing. That might be something, if we're still here, that might be something that people do. And it's just an established part of the Halloween tradition by that point.
Mm-hmm.
In much the same way that trick-or-treating's not particularly old. In its current form, obviously it's got much older heritage than that. And it's the same with Christmas. So it does make me think that people go looking for this ancient heritage that's not there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't need to be, because 200 years is still a pretty long time. I mean, it's longer than any human lifespan.
Yeah.
And I think that people develop their own traditions all the time anyway. And in some cases, that we're coming back to the family tradition again. What people do as a family tradition, to me, is almost more interesting than what people do en masse. Like our family traditions, me and my brother watch Die Hard every Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And I'll fight anyone who says it's not a Christmas film. And we always watch the Christmas episode of The Good Life on yeah. Christmas Day with our lunch. That's what we do. There's other films that we'll watch as well. It's A Wonderful Life and things, but they're yes. the main two that are non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And it's just something that we now do. Like, it's become a tradition for my dad to make the lunch, because he makes epic Christmas lunches. And I mean epic, you know, yeah. like they're a thing to behold. So I kind of feel like, to me, like, and also like we never send each other like Christmassy Christmas cards. They're always silly or funny ones with puns on them.
Yeah.
The more dreadful, the better. And you know, so to me, I knitted my own Christmas stocking one year, and I stupidly measured it against my own foot rather than using a Christmas stocking pattern. So I've got really big feet. So I've got this really long, thin foot on the stock. So, and I still hang it up, because why not? And my yeah. mom always finds some excuse to find something long and thin, usually like a bottle of shower gel or something, to hang in it. And if it's become a tradition, then I've got to remind myself to go and check it, because there's one year I forgot and I only found me present like the day we were taking the decorations down. But so to me, it's like those kind of traditions are way more interesting.
Yeah.
And yes, they're only about maybe 10 years old in some cases, but they're things that we do together and have therefore invested meaning in by continuing to do them.
Yeah.
And it's the continuation that makes them important.
Mm.
And the fact that that then adds to the little community of my family, rather than trying to say that the Romans did it, which would be hilarious if they did, like, I'm not going to lie. But, you know, I mean, that's the kind of thing I can imagine Pliny probably would have written down, someone having like an epically absurd long Christmas stocking just to fit more in it. But you know, so I think it, for me, I just kind of think it's people are allowed to concentrate on their own traditions and make their own traditions. They don't have to go looking for a historical precedent to it.
Yeah. And I think that's the other thing about folklore and tradition, I see, is that it is a malleable, changeable thing. Halloween is a prime example, especially how it is here in the UK, because often, as you refer to there, people will say, oh, trick-or-treating's it's just come from the Americans. But it actually came from Ireland. And they, you know, it was Irish immigrants who moved to the States who took it with them, and then it's come back and moved over here. But I remember growing up, and nobody trick-or-treated. It kind of started towards the mid-80s onwards, and that's when it kind of started to pick up. And I think a lot of that had to do with sort of popular culture and seeing films like E.T. and things where you know, the streets were full of kids wandering about, trick-or-treating, and it was a whole new thing here. And then, obviously, you look at other urban myths about don't go trick-or-treating, somebody's putting razor blades in bars of chocolate and all that kind of stuff. But that's developed so rapidly over the last 40 years to go from near enough nothing in the modern era, sort of post-war era, to now get to a point where we have people dressing their houses up and they have cinema screens showing scary movies, or people have floating ghosts outside their house and pumpkins and lights everywhere, even as you refer to there, that Halloween tree. And yet, if you go back 50 years, there was nobody doing it here in the UK at all, but I would imagine. I see. So Christmas is a very similar thing, and I think often we can kind of get wrapped up in looking back and thinking that's how it always was, whereas what we do now, Christmas these days doesn't bear resemblance to what it was when I was a kid growing up, primarily because for a lot of people they work Boxing Day, or we have, you know, big sales. I remember the days where Christmas Eve the shops had shut and that'd be it for near enough a week. Now,
and everyone would go and queue up for the Boxing Day sales that didn't start a week before Christmas.
Yeah, you know, I know people that used to go to bed at 9 o'clock on Christmas Day because they wanted to get up at 4 a.m. for the Boxing Day sale. And, I mean, I've never been in a state where I've been able to get up at 4 a.m. on Boxing Day. I can assure you of that. usually I'm going to bed. It's one of those things where I think often we look at how things change and adapt. And I think when it comes to things like Christmas, Krampus is a prime example of something that's really kind of caught fire over the last sort of 10 or 15 years. And it's very interesting how that aspect of a way people view folklore or a different tradition, and they've just basically taken the whole thing and just plonked it wherever they want. Because I would suspect you could ask anybody 20 years ago, and 99 out of 100 people would not know what you were talking about. You said, what can you tell me about Krampus?
Absolutely. And I think when you were just saying about how, like, say, Halloween and that is spread so rapidly because it was seen in films, I think Krampus is a really good example of, again, how popular culture has accelerated the adoption of a figure that most people have no real connection with, other than because they've seen him on the telly. And one of the things that I'm a big believer in people being inspired by folklore when they're writing fiction. Indeed, I've been inspired by folklore.
Yeah.
And people doing their own riffs on retellings and things like that. I'm a really big fan of all of that, because essentially you're then adding to the cultural narrative about certain ideas and so on.
Mm.
But the one thing I do take really badly with is when something then becomes commodified, and it sort of gets stripped of all its original meaning and its nuance, and it just becomes an excuse for merchandise, because that, to me, is when the figure sort of almost loses its potency. And Krampus, I think, is such an interesting character and such an interesting figure in folklore in general. And I think when you see, like, you know, the Krampus runs and things in Germany and Austria and so on, it sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
But then when they're like, Whitby has a Krampus run, why? You know, I sort of think, okay, that doesn't really necessarily make sense, because Krampus is not a figure who's part of our Christmas milieu, as it were.
Mm.
And I think, fair enough, if you want to have one, like, go nuts, have a great time and so on. But I do think that, again, he's on the verge of being commodified. And it's a shame, because I remember when I went to see the Krampus film at the cinema.
Yes.
As far as I was concerned, my favourite bit of the entire film was, apart from Toni Collette, because she's glorious, but was like the first like 5 minutes, like, you know, where there's an absolute bun fight in a shopping centre and they're all like fighting each other over Christmas presents.
Yeah.
And it was such a searing indictment of capitalism. I'm like, this is amazing. This is what I'm here for. And I think the film did a really good job of kind of poking at the over-commercialisation of Christmas and to the exclusion of that sense of, I don't want to say the family, because that's such a Victorian idea, but definitely community and people coming together and sharing time together away from, let's be honest, in the Northern Hemisphere, the fairly rubbish weather.
Yes.
And so I think for me, it's, the film really sort of underlined the problematic approach that some people have towards Christmas.
Mm.
And that was a weirdly subversive message, I thought, to put in a Christmas film. So I was kind of like, fair play to you. I appreciate that. That's in my wheelhouse. I have a feeling a lot of people possibly that one might have skipped them by. But I do think that it is funny seeing how Krampus has become this really popular figure. And what people keep referring to as like the anti-Santa and things like that. And I'm like, oh, he's really like he works in conjunction with, not in opposition to, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I love the Krampus legend, though. I do think he's really, and of course he's interesting when you then get the version that was taken to America and how he then developed in, I think it's the Appalachian area.
Mm.
So again, he's quite interesting to see how he then evolves and adapts to suit his new context. But yeah, I do kind of, when we start seeing like Krampus cuddly toys and things, then we'll know that there's a problem.
Yeah, and I think some of the European ones have a very dark aspect to them, as we touched on with there with Krampus, like you say. That's something I kind of became aware of about 10 years ago. I think I watched a documentary about the weird traditions of Christmas, and it was basically just going around Europe and some of these very strange things, you know, like Catalonia has these pooing Santas that are very odd, and is a big tradition there, and things about pooing in fireplaces and just really strange Christmas ones. And then you have things like Iceland where they have the Yule cat.
Yeah.
That basically, you know, if you've failed the test, then that's just going to come and eat you. And I like these kind of very different aspects to it, because often there is this kind of, here we have this, well, if you've been naughty, Father Christmas isn't going to bring you any presents. Whereas in the rest of Europe, as you say, Krampus doesn't work against Santa. He's basically his right-hand man, and he's the heavy. He comes round and sorts all the, you know, he takes the bad kids away, but he's working with Father Christmas or St. Nicholas, wherever you wish to put it. Whereas some of the other ones are just very odd, and I think, as you say, often we can just try and package a different country's tradition and just try and supplant it into our version of Christmas or the Yule period. And as you say, I find it very interesting that people are pulling traditions from other countries and trying to just say, well, we're doing this now. Well, why? Why are we doing it now? It's like Christmas markets, which 20 years ago in the UK, outside of maybe the major cities like London, Manchester, maybe Leeds, you'd be hard pressed to find a Christmas market. I would say this Christmas, I see, every major city and probably a lot of large towns in the UK will all be having a Christmas market, and they will all be sort of fake German ski huts and going for this kind of fake icicles everywhere and big plumes of snow all over the place.
I think it spoke volumes to me in 2019, because we've had a Christmas market around the monument for quite a few years.
Yeah.
And it used to be nice because you used to have sort of people selling the kind of stuff that you couldn't necessarily get in the shops.
Yeah.
So it was quite good. And then it sort of seemed to get taken over to the extent that in the 2019 one, my students and I had a bit of a joke going on, because it was like, oh, the bit at the end of the Truman Show where he notices that people go past his house in the same order, and it's the same three people on a loop. It felt like that when you walk past the stall. So it's like, right, I've gone past a churro stand, and now I'm going past noodles. Now it's bratwurst. Now it's churros. Now it's noodles. Now it's bratwurst. And it was really boring. And you would have these structures that were like the bratwurst stands, and they were like two stories high, and there'd be like sort of neon lights lit up everywhere, and it'd be like a windmill, and then there'd be a nativity scene on them. And you'd be like, wow, talk about mixed metaphors. And there's a tiny part of me when I look at the way things like that have been commodified, and then you think of actual Bible stories like Jesus throwing the money lenders out of the temple and stuff, and you think, Jesus would be horrified, he really would. And I think it's such a shame. I mean, it's like when Christmas starts on adverts on telly in like October.
Mm.
And the Christmas channels, I'm not kidding you, one of them was on Sky this year in July.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, you've peaked too soon, pal. It's no. And I think it's a shame because of the fact that for me, when you look at the darker folklore and indeed the tradition of telling ghost stories, because yes, it's only really been around since the Victorians, but it really taps into that time of year where it's it's not the darkest part of the year, because I would argue that's actually January.
Yeah.
But I think obviously just the way that the climate has moved, because obviously when you, because up here where you get snow in like January and February, not December, like December's often quite mild now.
Yeah.
Thanks to climate change. And it means that for me, you're then tapping into a dark time of year where you're about to close the door on the last year. So it's a bit of a liminal time anyway. Mm. And particularly those weird days between Christmas and New Year where you're not quite sure what day it is or how much you've eaten or where you are.
Yeah.
Unless you're back at work, of course. And the dark folklore kind of fits the mood. Mm. And it sort of suits that time of year. And it reminds you that no, a life isn't all a bed of roses. It's not always guaranteed to come up trumps.
Yeah.
And there are possibly things out there in the darkness that you don't want to come face to face with.
Mm.
And that's all being stripped away with all the glitz and nonsense and bright lights and everything. And I think Ronald Hutton sort of makes the point about Halloween, and I would argue the same is for Christmas, the fact that because a lot of our major holidays are now geared towards children,
mm-hmm.
the most interesting bits have been stripped out, or the figures have then been sanitised to make them child-friendly. And I sort of think, but at the same time, you know, why do we need to do that? You know, and I think that's where it's really funny, because in a way there is an argument to be made that that was the whole point of Yule. It was the darkest time of the year. Now let's celebrate the sun starting to come back.
Yeah.
And that's fair enough. But I think it's that conflation of the two, because Christmas and Yule aren't the same thing. That's where I think it starts to get a little bit muddy.
Mm.
And I think I'm not really sure how you get around it, because I think that the commercialism's probably here to stay. But I just wish that, like you say, people would stop just cherry picking from different sort of cultures and you know, different nationalities and so on, and stop just going, oh, we quite like this, we're just going to have it wholesale. Like when you see people in sort of in like late November, October, early November in sugar skull makeup, and I'm like, do we even understand what the Day of the Dead is? Like what you're doing?
Mm.
It's not just a costume for you to put on. And I sort of feel like Krampus has sort of fallen into the same kind of category.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things you could pick holes in all of it. You know, I often chuckle when I see 8-year-olds dressed as Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
You know, and you're thinking, well, you know, when I was growing up, these were terrifying monsters of film. And, you know, I would imagine a lot of kids who dress up like these characters have no, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, I see, but I would imagine some of them know who they are and may have seen some of these films, regardless of the age ratings on them. But for a lot of them, it's almost as if they're being put into costume. And I think it's the same kind of thing when it comes to Christmas, that there'll be people who will be sort of absorbing Krampus or the Yule Cat or other things where they don't really understand the story or the reasons for it. And I think, as with this kind of modern version, that we think everybody used to tell ghost stories at Christmas, and that's something that's dropped out of fashion recently, and it's only now coming back into fashion. But that's another thing that didn't used to happen a lot, and it's, as we were saying earlier, you know, it's only the BBC deciding to do something in the 70s that made that fashionable again. And then in more recent years, clearly Mark Gatiss from the League of Gentlemen was obviously a big fan of that kind of thing as well, and he's tried to resurrect it himself. And yet people will always say, oh, well, we stopped telling ghost stories at Christmas. But did we? I think we'd already stopped.
Yeah, and I think there's a really interesting conversation going on Twitter as well about the fact that as much as it's nice to see another ghost story at Christmas, does it have to be M.R. James?
Yes.
Does it have to be another late Victorian, early Edwardian, I think it is?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of writer, like, are there no writers now?
Mm.
Of course there are. There are loads of writers doing really interesting gothic stuff that you could quite easily adapt one of their ghost stories. But it's almost kind of, and I mean, as much as, again, I'm really pleased to see which one of the M.R. James stories they've actually chosen.
Mm.
At the same time, I thought you could have used that as an example, or an excuse rather, not an excuse, the wrong word, an opportunity to have given somebody new a platform.
Yeah.
Who's maybe doing something that better suits the times in which we live. So, you know, have an opportunity to actually comment on our context rather than some dusty old academic who never get out much.
Yeah. I mean, what was the one... I know, I've heard you mention it. I forgot the name of it. Was it Dead Space or Dead Air, which was the one that Mark Gatiss tried... did his own new version with Simon Callow in it?
I think it was Dead Air. And, oh, if Mark Gatiss is listening by any stretch of chance, like, babe, I love you, but that was terrible. And it tried so hard to nail an atmosphere that it just couldn't quite reach for.
Mm.
And I think the part of the problem is ghost stories for me work best when you're either 100% with the protagonist, like you feel like, oh my God, I don't want anything awful to happen to them. Or you can somehow put yourself in that person's shoes. And when you've got a fairly unlikable protagonist who's then like super wealthy and had this really like mad lifestyle as a celebrity, I can't do either of those things.
Mm.
And I just sort of felt like I could see what he was trying to do, but I just felt like it never quite reached the level of creepiness that it perhaps could have done.
Yeah.
Particularly when I know that he's capable of doing that with other projects.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just think it's one of those things where there's scope for that particular... And the thing is, like, no matter what story you do, someone will love it, somebody will hate it. That's just the nature of art. But I do feel like something vaguely Christmassy might be quite nice, like something actually seasonal.
Mm.
Because Christmas is technically such a weird time of year to start with.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is ripe for something that kind of encapsulates it all and gives it a darker slant. And I understand where you're coming from with that, because the biggest problem I have with that is that the central character is so unlikable that you're just hoping something horrible happens to them.
Yeah.
But no spoilers if you've not seen it. And Simon Callow, bless him, is fabulous. Is a fabulous actor anyway. So you kind of knew that there was something going to happen there. And it was kind of ticking the boxes, you know, weird noises and interference. Yeah, you kind of knew where we were going to go with that one. So before I let you leave, Icy, what's your favourite tradition at this time of year at Christmas? Have you got anything particular that you think we should look to kind of bring back? Or have you something that you've always thought was really interesting and needs more coverage or more focus on it, really?
It's hard because of the fact that I think, you know, so many of the Christmas traditions are so entrenched now. I think most people probably do them sort of anyway.
Mm.
I think, I mean, one thing that always springs to mind for me is, and this is such a dad joke thing, my granddad used to tell my mother that the reason why it was called Boxing Day was because it was the day when all the kids had to put their toys back in their boxes. And I just thought that was glorious. I think, and this isn't a Christmas tradition in a folklore sense at all, but I think there are loads of places this year who are going to be offering, or basically opening their doors and offering like Christmas dinners for single people. Mm. So if you don't have a family to go and spend Christmas with, you can then go and have like a Christmas dinner with a community of people.
Yeah.
And I think that it would be such a lovely tradition if people made it part of their Christmas to maybe knock back on, if obviously this is something that's within their financial budget, obviously, but if they could maybe like knock back on something that they would maybe have and donate something towards one of those, because I know I'm certainly going to be doing that.
Yeah.
Because I just sort of feel like Christmas is supposed to be a time for community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helping other people to be able to take part in that community, you know, is a really sort of valuable, and that sounds like a proper like Miss America sort of answer. But you know, because I can't really think of any of the actual folklore sort of traditions. I mean, one of the things we do as a family, and this is because we like to do things the wrong way around, we always go down to the cemetery where my grandparents and great-grandparents are,
mm-hmm.
give their graves a bit of a clean, put some poinsettia or some fake poinsettias out for them, which we then swap back with the other fake flowers afterwards, so at least, you know, they don't wilt and stuff.
Yeah.
And we'll go and fill them in on the news since the last time we saw them.
Mm.
So We kind of moved the celebration of the dead bit from Halloween to Christmas, because I don't know why we did that, but we did. I think it was just because obviously everyone was always going to be off work at Christmas, so we moved it. So, you know, again, you could always include, you know, widen your community slightly to include your ancestors as well.
Mm.
You know, there's no reason why you can't move some of the Halloween practices.
Yeah.
You know, create your own traditions. That's what I would love people to do. Make your own Christmas traditions. And if you want to start telling ghost stories at Christmas, and you know, like, instead of watching whatever god awful thing BBC's got on at Christmas, or you know, if you want to, you know, kind of like skip the usual sort of like post lunch nap and do something, you know, sort of like with whoever you're with, whoever that might be, even if it's just you and your pet.
Yeah.
You know, then I think that to me would be getting to the heart of what that time of year always has sort of like running as a theme through all of the practices.
Yeah. Well, I think that's very sweet. And I think, you know, I know several people that do something very similar. I see at Christmas that they go and visit their departed relatives to keep them up to date and to sort of start their Christmas. So I don't think that's strange in the slightest. I think that's rather sweet and lovely. So all power to you and your family.
Not words that I ever usually apply to me, but it has to be said.
First time for everything. Oh, well, listen, thank you so much for your conversation today. It's been absolutely fabulous to finally get a chance to have a conversation with you and dive into your work and your history and how you've got to the point that you have. Where can everybody keep up to date? And I will recommend it highly to follow your wonderful podcast.
You can find the podcast Fabulous Folklore on, I'm pretty sure it's on most, if not all, of the platforms. So obviously that would be the likes of Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever it's called now. You can also find it on YouTube. The whole backlog's not on YouTube yet, because obviously I only started doing the videos at a certain point. But and it's just the audio and a static visual. So if you still want to like listen on the TV while you're doing something else, then obviously it's on YouTube as well. You can find information about obviously the blog posts that each of these podcast episodes accompany. The links to my Patreon, my books, all that kind of stuff is all on my website, which is icysedgwick.com. Sedgwick only has one E, I should point out, because that always trips people up. And if you're the kind of person who would rather pick and choose kind of which episodes you listen to, you can always subscribe to my email list, and then I send an email out every week with the link to the blog post and the podcast episode, so you can kind of pick and choose which ones you want to listen to. And if you sign up to that, I will send you my free guide to protecting your home using folkloric methods. I do still recommend having a burglar alarm and like locking the door, but these are also just some quite, it's just like a light-hearted guide to sort of everyday folk practices for home protection. And the link for that is also on my website as well.
Absolutely. And a fantastic guide it is, but I also agree with your point there of using it in conjunction with modern methods.
Not instead of.
Yes, because there's only so much a mirror facing your door can do.
Exactly.
Well, Icy, thank you so much again for joining me, and I wish you all the very best and hope you and your family have a lovely Christmas. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, and the same to you.